This is an app for someone who's gone to the bathroom and forgot their phone. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, yeah.
It's that or read the shampoo bottle, right?
So I mean, that's a common problem. I know. I run into that and I'm like, are you serious? No way.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
It's been awesome seeing all the subscriptions, reviews, retweets, and more from all of you. It's really been fantastic.
Yeah, Paul, that's been awesome. I agree. Now, you've been quite busy the past couple of weeks, haven't you? You know, I've kind of been living vicariously, you know, through Twitter, not only, you know, through you, but many of the other developers I follow, you know, NS Spain, that one looked particularly fun. So I want to start the show real quick, just a quick chat. Give us a recap of all these conferences, because it looked like a blast.
Yeah, September is just conference season for iOS. I think we have 9 or 10 in 1 month. And I'm speaking at 5 in 5 different countries. It's really intense.
And you told me before, you do new talks every time. You don't repeat talks. So this is 5 different talks.
Every new talk is completely new. I do it once, toss it away, and do another one next time, which is challenging, but it means you get the presentation. You're there to see it. You know, you could otherwise just see it online. So yeah, it's nice to be able to do customized talks for the events. So at the start of the month, I went to iOS Dev UK in Wales at a wonderful conference. Really, really small town, university town. So everyone travels out there on this on a train, almost like the Hogwarts Express going to this place. And because you're in the middle of nowhere, it really is very cut off. You eat all your meals together for 4 days. You really get to make some great friends there. I actually met, for the first time ever, Quinn the Eskimo.
Never heard of them.
Well, yeah, if you ever use Apple's developer forums and you see responses from Apple, I think almost 100% come from Quinn the Eskimo. He responds to almost everything on there, I think. He's real. I thought it was like a whole team of people. It's the pseudonym Quinn the Eskimo, but he's real, the real guy.
And it's just one person just answering all those?
Yeah, doing, you know, UIKit or AppKit or networking, whatever, just jumping around really fast, doing a great job. And he's lovely. He's a really nice guy. He obviously loves his job very much, and he's been there a long time, so he's going nowhere.
Nice. Now, which one had the bike tour? Because I saw a ton of pictures of the bike tour on Twitter, and that looked right. Awesome.
Yeah, that was Swift and Fika in Stockholm. It's a new event, actually. It's a first time doing this. It's obviously a beautiful city. There's so much water around there. And the social events, one of them was a city bike tour. We had a 4-hour bike tour around Stockholm. Great way to meet friends. But they also had bouldering, they had a VR arcade experience, they had some photography work you could do. So it was a huge way to meet folks. Plus they had some great speakers too.
Now, and then you just got back from NS Spain, which that one looked like the most fun to me based on the pictures, all the wine drinking, that one. And I remember back when we hung out during DubDub, you know, a few months ago, you were trying to, you know, recommend me to submit a talk. And I was kind of going back and forth. But man, after seeing those pictures, I'm 1000% submitting a talk next year. That looked like a blast. Yeah.
So it's set in this, again, a lovely small town called Logroño in north of Spain. And directly after the conference is the San Mateo Wine Festival. So you meet all the amazing speakers they have. It's a AAA lineup. People like Daniel Steinberg, Guillermo Rambo, Christina Fox, David Long, Ellen Shapiro. And it's like, hey, let's go for wine or go for tapas together. And it's just, it's a lovely community event. It works really, really well.
Yeah, hopefully I'll see you there next year.
Next year. Well, I can't go back next year because you're only allowed to speak every other year maximum. You can't follow on. They want new speakers, so this could good. Be it.
Maybe I can fill that slot.
Do it.
Up next, we have the news portion of the show. And to kick off the news section, we're going to update a story from last episode where we talked about raw strings in Swift. So we're not going to dive into the details, but if you want to learn about that, go ahead and listen to last episode. But basically, that was using the pound sign or the hashtag as your raw string delimiter, and that allowed you to, you know, represent your raw strings how you liked. When we talked about that last episode, that was in review, came down the pipeline just a couple days ago. That has been officially accepted.
It's great news. I've been noodling around with Swift 5 these last few days, and it makes things like regular expressions significantly easier to read because it halves the number of backslashes required in your string. Plus, it works great in multi-line strings too. It's just a great Swift feature.
Next up, we have optional binding to upgrade self from weak to a strong reference, and that has been actually implemented. So basically what this means is when you're dealing with Swift closures, it's very common to capture self as a weak reference in order to avoid a retain cycle. Currently, this is typically done, you know, by using a variable, most commonly named strong self. But you know, that does vary from code base to code base, as everybody names variables differently. And I actually liked how the proposal described it. It says, or it may be a random sequence of characters that captures the developer's mood at the moment. And that's often, that's how I feel about a lot of naming sometimes. I'm like, where did you come up with this name? So that kind of made me laugh when I read that in their proposal. But the main benefit here is consistency, right, Paul? It's like, now that you can just say guard let self equal self, you get that consistent naming. So what are your thoughts on this?
So I used to use roundabout names for all guard let blah equals blah, always. And Erica Sadun's book, Swift Style, made me change. She said, listen, it's perfectly normal to rebind to the same constant name. Just do that. So I switched across the board. So you're right. It's nice to be able to do the same thing for self now. It makes this consistency with the rest of the code. So again, another smart, simple, totally additive improvement for Swift. It breaks nothing.
Next up, Paul, I have some breaking news. Literally just came across my Twitter feed. It's not in our script, so like I don't want to like, you know, put you on the spot, but did you know Apple's launching some devices? Did you know that?
No way. Yeah, I know. Tell me more, Sean.
I know. Thanks to our good buddy Guy Rambo there, who let us know that weeks in advance, so we kind of knew everything. But yes, Apple did announce their phones and watches. We won't go into all the details because by now you already know that you've ordered.
But some details, surely, Sean. What device did you order? We all want to know.
I only got the Apple Watch 44 millimeter space gray. I didn't get the phone because I already have the X. Yes, the X, and. That is because I just didn't think the X to the XS or was just that big of an upgrade. I think if you don't have the X yet, it's a great upgrade. What are your thoughts, Paul?
I went for a Series 4 as well and a XS Max. But I honestly wasn't sure about XS Max until I saw the size comparison. It's basically the same size as an 8 Plus, I thought. I've been there with 7 Plus. It was fine getting off the XS Max. Anyway, carry on.
well, real quick, you're going from the Series 3 to the Series 4. I'm going from the Series 0 to the Series 4.
Oh my goodness.
I'm expecting a night and day difference. In fact, I haven't even worn my watch for the past year because it was unbearable. So I'm expecting magic.
You'll be blown away. It's huge. Anyway. Hopefully.
Yeah, I can't wait. So now back in last episode, Paul, I remember, you know, kind of hinting at this announcement, and you said you were excited to see what APIs we got. So were you happy with what we got?
They released a new video talking about how to design for the XS, and it's basically use auto layout and safe area insets. That was it. Like, we kind of knew that one, Apple. But there is one new API, or at least one new big hint to use. And it's so small, and it's effectively that the UI split view controller in landscape behaves now like the iPad does in portrait, because it's a plus size device, so it'll slide in and out as it needs to. And that's pretty much it. I mean, it's like, ooh, you know, thanks.
and like you mentioned, it wasn't too many design changes. I mean, the notch is everywhere, even on the lower end phone now. It's not that much lower end. It's got all the same internals, the XR or 10R. So that was kind of expected. Now, the good news for developers here is that last year, if you adhere to the safe area like Apple recommended for all your layouts, you're pretty much not going to have to change anything. Or if you have any work, it's going to be very, very minimal, like Paul just mentioned about the split view. So that is good news. There's minimal work for the layout, nothing too crazy. Next up, Paul, let's talk about this beast that is the A12 Bionic chip. This almost got me to upgrade, but I still held off, because it does seem super powerful. And I remember back during our Dub Dub Hangout, you know, you mentioned that when we were talking about CreateML, how awesome it was going to be when we can do on-device machine learning. So with this huge improvement in the A12 chip, are we there yet? Are we getting close? What are your thoughts?
So it's according to Apple, 9 times faster at 1/10 the battery power. It was ridiculously fast before, and it's like 500 million or something, or billion. I've lost track. So I think it's 500 billion instructions a second it did before, and now it's 6 trillion. So it's utter overkill compared to everywhere all of Apple's competitors are. They're just pushing it further and further and further. So they've obviously got a reason for this. They've got a plan. And I want to get on board. I would say it does not allow us to do on-device machine learning, sadly. That's a software feature we're missing still. But it certainly puts in the right place for it. And I do wonder whether, you know, because of the way Apple works, left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing sometimes. Now it's all announced, the CoreML team think, oh, we could probably use that. So maybe 12.2 or something, they might get around to adding that, or whatever X3 comes next year.
Yeah.
It'd be nice.
Yeah. onto our picks of the weeks. Now, this is where each week we talk about something we learned this week that we want to share with you. Paul, what do you got for us this week?
So I've been noodling around with Swift 5 as much as possible, and I'm really loving a new method there called compact map values attached to dictionaries. And it brings together compact map from arrays plus map values from dictionaries. Have you been using those so far, Sean?
No, not really. I've been sticking to, you know, trying to get my head around 4.2. I'm not quite on Swift 5 yet. Right. So, but didn't compact map kind of replace flat map recently? So I'm still trying to play catch up a little bit with this.
Yeah, it was confusing. So in 4.1 and earlier, flat map was overloaded to mean multiple things. And they cleared it up completely in 4.2. Flat map is still there doing its thing with optionals, but there's compact map now with its new behavior, which is the old flat map for arrays. And it basically says, transform all the values in my sequence somehow, like convert strings to integers. Then unwrap the results that which are optional and discard any that's nil. So if you had 1, 5 fish and said make integers, you'd get back optional 1, optional 5, nil. It would then unwrap 1 and 5 to make just 1 and 5 and discard the nil. So you get back a real array of integers saying 1 and 5 is very helpful.
So you're describing compact map, right? Now, the new thing, right?
That's compact map on arrays.
Okay.
And there's map values from dictionaries, because you can't map dictionaries easily because dictionaries can't have duplicate keys, of course. So to avoid the risk of you having duplicate keys, they have a special method called map values that leaves the key names intact as they were guaranteed unique, and transforms just the values. So that's compact map from sequences and map values from dictionaries combined together makes a new Swift 5 method called compact map values. And it does the two of those things together. So you had a dictionary of things with some a transformation, a map that would create nil values. It will compact them as part of the compacting step. So you get the best of both worlds in one method.
Now, I know giving code examples via podcast is super difficult, and we try to avoid that when we can, but do you have a simple example you can give to kind of help illustrate this new concept? Because this is a very new concept to me, so I'm sure there's many listeners out there that are in my shoes as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if you imagine a dictionary of people in a bike race, for example, along with times they took to finish in seconds, you might have, say, Hudson as a key, 38 seconds as a value, Clark took 42 seconds, Robinson took 35 seconds, Hartis gets DNF, which is do not finish, mm-hmm. but it's a string, DNF. So you've got all these values as strings and all these keys as strings. And you might want to say, okay, I want to convert all those value strings, the time strings, into integers. And of course, DNF is a real string. You can't make an integer out of that. You get nil right. back. So you could say, hey, take all my times, use compact map values with the integer constructor, the initializer, and you'd get back Hudson 38 as an int, Clark 42 as an int, and Hartis with DNF would be eliminated entirely from the return value, would go away, so it would fail the test, return nil, and be removed as part of the compacting step. Honestly, it's just one line of code. It's super, super fast.
Yeah, that makes sense. That was a great example, actually.
What was your pick this week, Sean?
So my pick this week was an article by Joe Chaplinsky, I believe is how you pronounce it, and that was all about surfacing shortcuts. Now, I'm a big believer in shortcuts. I think it can be game-changing in how we interact with our phones. However, I think we as third-party developers are going to play a major part in that.
This is the new API in iOS 12, right?
Yeah, to create shortcuts via Siri, where you create a phrase and basically it runs, you know, the behavior in your app. So, for example, in this app that we're about to talk about, it's called Recaf. It's where you log your caffeinated beverages. So the example would be log, Swift over coffee. Good little plug.
Yeah, brand. I love it.
Right. So it would be logging, coffee, 8 ounces, right? And you would log whatever caffeinated beverage you had with the volume, and so again, tracking your caffeine intake. So what this Siri shortcut would do is you would basically just say, hey, Siri, I don't want to trigger everybody, log my coffee. And, you would set up, you want it to always be 8 ounces and coffee, and it would log that. So basically it saves the user from going into the app and actually logging it. So the tricky thing with shortcuts is it's a brand new thing, and most of the app users aren't going to know it exists. So as developers, that is a problem. And we have to do a good job of surfacing these shortcuts to let users know about it because, like Joe says, and I'm right there with him, this could be potentially one of the most powerful features to come out in iOS 12 and, again, change the way we use our phones. So some of the examples he uses, and I can't show screenshots, obviously, on a podcast, but some examples to really get this in front of the users was to add a microphone button on his UI. So, for example, remember we're logging coffee, so it would be coffee with a giant 8-ounce button, and he has a little microphone icon next to that. So he's relying on the user's curiosity, which he admits is not the best, because when the user taps that, he pops up the Apple's create shortcut, and Apple takes it from there. So again, he does say that's not the best, but he does another way, and this is putting up a full screen modal with the, hey, create shortcuts. Now, hear me out when I talk about this full screen modal, because we don't like to block the user's experience, right, in general. He only pops this up conditionally. So after a user does the same behavior that a shortcut would be good for. Again, back to our coffee example of using 8 ounces, you're logging 8 ounces every time. After you've logged 8 ounces 5 times, the next time you go to log that, he blocks them with the modal and says, hey, this looks like it'd be good for a shortcut. Why don't we create that?
That's really nice. That's a smart way of doing it. There's also an actually dedicated API called Set Shortcut Suggestions. And it lets you effectively pre-register shortcuts that you recommend the user to try out. So rather than doing it after the fact, you do it ahead of the fact. So if they go into there for the other app reasons, they'll see your app in there already saying, have you tried A, B, and C? So you can put like your app's best things in there away, ready for them to see and stumble across sort of proactively, as it were.
Again, we as developers are going to have to come up with a creative number of ways to get this in front of the user. And I thought this was a good example of two ways. Again, with the button icon with the microphone, and then based on the user's behavior, we can pop up a modal explaining how great shortcuts are and here's why you should create them, and let's go.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we don't know yet if shortcuts will work. I mean, it could crash and burn for all we know, or it could be the most important thing in years. It's one of those things where if you don't do it, and it's huge, you'll be kicking yourself for a long time. Whereas if you do it, and it's nothing, then you've just lost a week or two of work. It's not a massive issue. And the API is actually really simple. You know, there's two APIs. One is trivial to use, you know, talking 10 minutes to add and test and so forth. So there's no reason not to do it, even the easy version.
Yeah, and that's great to know, like you just said. Even if you're stubborn and you don't want to do it, if you realize you're wrong in the future, like you just said, Paul, it's not a ton of work to get in there.
Yeah. Next up, it's time for our open ballot section. And our question this episode is, what makes for a great Swift job interview? We got a stack of great responses from readers. One of the most common one was to do take-home projects. Roddy Munro said, a project you're given to work on before the interview, and then you have to explain why you made certain decisions.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of take-home projects, and this is just a personal thing probably. I don't do well in the nerve-wracking atmosphere of on a whiteboard with somebody looking over your shoulder. I much prefer to sit at home in my environment. You know, let me take the time to do what I can do, and then we talk about it, and you can assess it, and you can ask me all the questions in the world you want about it. But I could be typing my name, and Paul, if you're looking over my shoulder, I'm going to misspell it. So I just don't do well in an atmosphere. So I prefer the take-home project.
No, the struggle is real. It is hard. But what I find when I was hiring was asking the questions about why did you choose that? Why did you choose this? That's where the real value is, because you get amazing answers. You know, the hardest part in interviewing someone is having them open up and get in the flow and feel like they're really getting their voice heard well. Having a good discussion, it's difficult. We had a response from Swifty McSwiftface saying he wants real world problems with a relevant IDE with full internet access. And Suhit Patil said something very similar. Yes, it's important to have iOS concepts like threading, animations, and networking, and so forth, but you're looking at how they structure code and apply those concepts. We had some answers here about personal projects. We had one from Eric Cricklow saying, request sample code from a personal project. How you write code when no one else is looking tells a lot about you. And it's so true, because I noticed recently that developers I know, and I guess myself too, will code review much more precisely and specifically than they would their own code. So I'd review someone else's code much more pernickety. I'd pick holes and find nitpicks in an encouraging way than I would in my own code. I'd get away with things I did way more than I would let someone else get away with.
Yeah, and this is a good point, kind of going back to the take-home project, because I've done many take-home projects, and yeah, I go above and beyond. I review the code 6 times, super nitpicky, and to your point, I might not do that in normal day-to-day, but because I know my code is being graded, maybe it isn't an accurate representation. I know I'm kind of contradicting myself based on what I said, but this is all coming to me as I speak. So yeah, like Eric mentions, like if you already had a project done, like, hey, don't edit this project, just send it to me as is, and then we can talk about it.
There's an answer from Pedro ML Brito, who said, I usually ask the applicant to explain something they're proud of coding and why, and also something they regret. Which is very interesting because he says, why did you do it that way and how did you do it the right way? And that's fascinating because I've written some terrible code in my time. But if you're able to get something positive from that and say, hey, I know this bit sucks, but someone was sick or we had deadline pressures or the client changed a spec, whatever it is, if I had more time, I would have done ABC. Or with reflection, in hindsight, having learned more, I'd have done DEF and so forth.
Yeah, and like we mentioned earlier, the conversations around the why of the code is, I think, the most enlightening for the interviewer and a chance to really showcase your knowledge for the interviewee. And kind of to your point of writing bad code sometimes, I often feel like, at least in my career, I had to write the bad code before I knew better to write the good code, right? It was like a stepping stone. So that bad code was kind of necessary.
Sometimes the best way to know what's right is to see what's wrong.
Exactly.
We had some answers about problem solving, one from Robert Ramirez saying, I think the best interviews are the ones that give you the best feel for the job, the company, and the people you'll be working with, solving problems you'll encounter on the job, and collaborating with the people you'll be working with. And Kristaps Grinberg said, I heard that in Stripe, they ask you to solve a small issue for any open source project, which tests how you can navigate an unknown code base. That sounds like a real challenge to me.
Yeah, and I think that's a very valuable challenge. I've never had to do that, but just reading Kristaps' answer, I was like, wow, that would be a really good challenge. And I also think a very good test, because like you said, navigating a unknown code base is what you're going to have to do when you go to a new company. Most developers spend the first X amount of weeks just getting familiar with their environment and the code base. So the more adept you are at that, the better. I want to touch on what Robert Ramirez said about getting the best feel for the people you work with. I feel the team you're working with is one of the most valuable things. And as the interviewee, don't forget that you're also interviewing them, right? You want to make sure that that job is going to be a right fit for you. You're going to enjoy going to work every day and enjoy the people you work with.
Yeah, finding the right fit is challenging, both from both sides, to be fair. Finding a company that fits you and finding applicants that suit you. But I've seen some terrible advice out there. I saw a book, honestly, saying there's a company and they found the best way to find someone who fitted their company was, now take off your jeans and run around the office to show that you'll be one of us. Sure, wow. You can fit in. I thought, what a humiliating experience to put people through. And everyone who worked there had been through that and did it. I don't want to work with those people.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, just remember you're interviewing them and make sure it's a good fit for you. I know, especially those of you that are looking for your first developer job, often it's very enticing to just jump at the first offer you get. But just make sure it's a good situation because you could regret it in the long run.
It's true. There were some answers on algorithms, but they were, I'm so glad to see, they were negative answers. So Dan Munoz, who I've just met at NS Spain, he gave a great talk on internationalization and culturalization of apps. He said, definitely not so much on algorithms and data structures. It's useful, but doesn't tell the whole story. And our friend Shai Mashali said, not an algo or whiteboard question. And this is so true. It baffles me. Baffles me why companies say, take this binary tree and futz with it. Who does that in their real job? Database developers, maybe. The vast majority of us, sadly, have much more mundane jobs. Make this table view faster. Make this thing stop leaking memory. Fix this bug in iOS 11.3 in French on iPad mini, whatever it is, right?
That's very specific.
Yeah, but that's what they kind of have. That's the Jira bugs no one wants to fix, right? They're sitting there looking, staring at you, mocking you silently. But the actual chance of you being told, listen, implement quicksort,
Yeah, I mean, I turn around and I look back at my Cracking the Coding interview book, and the only time I ever even look at that is when I'm preparing for interviews. It's like that whole interview, the whiteboard stuff, is just a completely different skill in and of itself. And like Dan says, I don't want to make it sound like it's completely useless. Having that, you know, base knowledge is helpful, but if you're using that to determine, especially iOS developers, whether to hire or not, I just think that's wrong.
If you want to measure skill, ask them, take some JSON, put it at the table view. How fast can you do it? that's like a quarter of our job right there, you know? Yep. And finally, we had one from someone called Ion who said, to my experience, knowing all the important aspects of why Swift is awesome, and on top of that, how long one has worked with Swift and how much one is engaged with the community. What do you think, Sean?
So there's some debate on Twitter, and this isn't the exact where this question is going, but I want to talk about this as well, about how should people that work on, you know, 10 side projects, give talks all the time, have a podcast, you know, I'm not sure who I'm talking about here, but should you expect all developers to do that? You know, and the argument is, you know, developers need to have the work-life balance, the family life. Just because a developer doesn't do it their entire day doesn't mean they're bad. So I do see where everyone's coming from there, but I do think having passion for what you do, and most people that do give the, you know, the blog post, the podcast, they have passion for this. And kind of like Ion says, is I think that is, I want to hire people with passion for their job. I don't necessarily want to, and maybe this is controversial, work with people that are just like, I'm here for the 9 to 5. I don't care about Swift at all. I just want to work with passionate people about what I'm passionate about. It's a shared passion.
So I just got back from NS Spain, and there was a Who Can Do Swift the Best competition. I looked at the board and loads of folks had taken part, and the best score was 1,300 points. And stupidly I thought, I'll give it a quick go. And I won an Apple TV. I came first.
I saw you tweet about that. Now, without going too much into it, right, because we're running short on time, how do you judge who can do Swift the best? Like,
it's rapid fire questions. You get like 1 or 2 minutes to answer as many hard questions about Swift as you can. Like, what will this output? What does this mean? What does that mean? And I got 2,000 points, so I won Apple TV.
Well, I was going to say, for somebody that's written many, many books on Swift, why did you think you wouldn't win?
I was genuinely just curious. That's what I was just curious. I want to give it a try. Intellectual curiosity. What have they
done?
Sure,
yeah.
I hadn't planned to win. I have an Apple TV already. My parents have a new one, perhaps.
I was just going
to
ask, what'd you do with the Apple TV?
My parents will have a new one. They had my old one. You know what it's like? You've got these big chain of devices you don't need anymore. They have my old one. They've got the new one. But what I'm saying is that if I ask you to sit an IQ test, I'm not measuring your intelligence. You can't measure intelligence. What I'm measuring is your ability to sit IQ tests. Right? And if I set someone a Swift test, I'm not measuring necessarily how good they are at making iOS apps. I'm measuring how good they are at doing Swift tests, how comfortable they are in that testing environment. And I dislike the place we are right now where we frown on folks who don't do it in their spare time because they have other things. And people genuinely have to care for folks younger than them or older than them or go and live a rich life outside of coding. That's what diversity means. They bring so much more to the job in terms of fresh ideas than someone who spends all their time coding. So, you know, obviously I spend a lot of time coding. I do a lot of speaking and so on. But I have so much respect for people who say, it's 5 o'clock now. I'm going to go and play my guitar or go rally driving or do some knitting or whatever their passion is. Something else that's not coding.
So that's going to do it for episode 2 of Swift Over Coffee. Before we go, we want to put out the next open ballot question, and that is about conferences. Given that most conferences post their videos online, is it still worthwhile to go in person? And if you never go to conferences in person, like, what are some of the main reasons why you don't? So we want to talk about some conferences next time. Again, that wraps it up. Tell your friends to subscribe. Thank you for all the support. You can follow us on Twitter at Swift Over Coffee. See you next episode.
Bye. Say I should.